Audi.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. What is most wonderful about doing this podcast is the breadth of people we have on. And today's guest grew up living a life as far removed from mine and I imagine many of yours lives as possible. Hands up if you've been lost in the Sahara Desert overnight with only the stars to guide you to safety, or been so hungry wandering the Himalayas with your dad that you've had to barter for and then slaughter a live mutton for your evening meal. He's now an internationally acclaimed artist exhibiting all over the world. Yes, it's fair to say that today's guest is pretty fascinating. Let's give him the full Big Travel Podcast treatment. Born in Tehran, the descendant of a nomadic tribe, contemporary artist Firuz Farman Farmayan's family scattered after the Islamic Revolution from Paris to Marrakesh and his father's houseboat on a lake in Kashmir. He grew up trekking mountains and deserts with his father, later travelling the world with his indie rock band and now with his internationally acclaimed art. He travels the globe working with craftswomen in remote regions. Recently returned from a five-week trek around Kyrgyzstan to research his exhibition, Gates of Tehran, for the Venice Biennale, it's Firuz Farman Farmayan.
I am in room 304 of a very wonderful art hotel, boutique art hotel called the Atenas Greek Hotel Palace, just off Omonia Square in the old city of Athens. I have the honor of being the neighbor of Mr. Pericles, that was the founder of the city, and coming in from a five-week trek, sourcing production trip into Central Asia. So we just pulled out of Central Asia to Istanbul 2 days ago.
I need to know about this trip, and I think that's a very good place to start. And I also, you're my first ever guest that's actually told me their hotel room, so congratulations and thank you for that. But let's start with the trip, because I spoke to you just before you were going on your trip. We had a telephone conversation, and I thought it sounded absolutely incredible. So you've just come back from a five-week trek. Tell us about that.
Well, it is a trek because it did take us to the highlands of the Kyrgyz Republic that we commonly like to call Kyrgyzstan, which is the border of Central Asia. It actually borders the whole of China on its eastern side. It's got Kazakhstan on one side, Tajikistan down south, and Uzbekistan down south. So it's a landlocked country, it's got common points with Switzerland in Europe, as it is a mountainous country. The capital is set at about 900 meters on the Kazakh plain. But that's just a minimal fraction of the territory, because the whole country basically just takes off into what they call the Tian Shan Range that separates it from China. It is the whole country. It's a mountainous volume. And what is beautiful about it is that through the fact that it's a mountainous volume, it has kept it from a lot of invasions, a lot of sedentarizational processes through the ages, and it has for itself a pristine nomadic tradition that that compared to other cultures is mostly untouched.
So why were you trekking through these 5 weeks? You're a cultural ambassador, I do believe, and also researching your artwork.
Well, I could use the one of my favorite words is interweaving is something that I like very much because it can be metaphoric, it can be cultural, it can be material. You interweave ideas that come together and ultimately show patterns and in my case, artworks. So to present myself, yes, I am a contemporary artist that works in what I call a pluralist approach, a multivalent approach of cultural interaction. I like to say that it is important in our time and age to connect to archaic cultures that sometimes have a lot more to teach us through the prism of contemporary practice, meaning I'm trying to find bridges in between millenary traditions and future-looking technologies, obviously, and practices. So in this sense, I have been brought to work with different tribes before I started working with Kyrgyzstan, because my father is based in Morocco, and I grew up in Morocco after the Iranian Revolution. We are an exiled family. Makes me, as I said, when I met the Minister of Culture, Mr. Azamat, in Bishkek, which is the capital of Kyrgyzstan. Very, very, very interesting architecture. The Soviet brutalist legacy is just marvelous to see. It's like frozen since the 1991 fall of the wall, and you have this very incredible atmosphere there. But to close this parenthesis, I met with Mr. Azamat and I said, yes, what really links me to your culture is that myself, having lost my country to the Iranian Revolution in 1979, made me a citizen of the world, meaning I have a nomadic lifestyle. I myself travel between cultures, and that basically is the matter and the material, the first material I use in my artworks. In this sense, I came up with the idea of working with a Central Asian country, and by a process of studying an exploration, Kyrgyzstan, because we say Kyrgyzstan, we can also say Kyrgyzstan, mm-hmm. Or the Kyrgyz Republic. Became an obvious choice. I mean, they are, as I said earlier, a very untouched culture. They have, they had their cultural identity was untouched until the arrival of the Russians in the 18th century, which industrialized most of the country until the fall of the Soviet bloc, where the country took its independence in the 1990s, right? So you have that very, interesting material to study, in my sense, and to go there and to approach the Ministry of Culture. I came up with my curator, Mrs. Esveva Manfredi Zavaglia. That's a decorated friend and curator and art. An art producer from Rome that's curating the show in view of the Venice Biennale. So that was the whole thing. We came up saying to Kyrgyzstan, why not turn Firuze's idea into your pavilion? And it actually made a lot of impact, and it brought us to meet with the government there and have us sign an agreement, sending me as their cultural ambassador in view of their pavilion in April next year.
So what did the trek actually involve? When you say trekking, were you walking? How were you traveling?
Well, we got to the city of Bishkek, which is the capital at first, advised by a production company, a French production company I know, that had just shot a film there regarding the Uyghur situation. And we were in a very, very nice hotel there. And rapidly, we had to organize our trip into what I call, when I go into the process of exploration and finding the material to create my art, I go in what I call sourcing/production trips. And that brings us to find a driver, to go to the highlands, to the mountains, and go to where the craftswoman, I mostly work with craftswomen in this specific case, as I'm also transforming the cupola of a yurt. I also work with the son of a craftswoman that's a yurt master builder. And we basically went in what, in the northern part of Kyrgyzstan, is called the Issyk Kul region. a region in Kyrgyz, which is ancient Turkic. It's called an oblast, which is a beautiful name. And so we went into Issyk-Kul Oblast and into Narin Oblast, that are two regions that are very much touched by the industrial letdown that happened after the Soviet bloc retired. Because what happened is that these people were the wool makers of all Russia at the time. Just imagine how much jobs were lost when they had to move from a kolkhoz-based system into a capitalist system. And I think there were about 20 million heads of mutton there that was producing wool in the 1990s. We only have 3 million now. So it just gives you an idea to how much the production of crafts there was touched in these highlands. As I went there, and I was there, and my job, as an artist, I call it the virtuous circle, is to highlight these crafts and give them, as a lot of other countries have, a thriving or tourism or a crafts industry to help them go forward or modernize their business plan. So I went towards these different structures along the way, because I met structures, what they call co-ops. And you understand that because of the popularization of the craft making in the highlands, in the Issyk-Kul region, for instance, a couple of associations that are, obviously you have a lot of international associations that are trying to fund and help these co-ops. And and I went towards not only independent weavers, but also towards those ONGs, right? And or OGMs, what do we call them? Government-backed production companies that are helping the crafts there. And the UNESCO is also present there, that I met too, through the UN. And basically the most interesting part of the trip, or let's say the most central part of the trip, had to do with me driving around one of the biggest mountainous lakes in the world, called the Issyk-Kul Lake, that is a dark, very stark, very beautiful in its harshness, a lake that's about 1.5, 1.6 kilometers high, surrounded by the Tian Shan, that are like white peaks surrounding this this beautiful lake, which used to be, in the Soviet times, mind this, a torpedo testing ground for submarines. I learned that as I was going there, and the first town I got to on the Issyk-Kul region is called Karakol. And Karakol is the furthest town you can get up north in Kyrgyzstan, which brings you to about 100 and 140 clicks from the Chinese border. And Gara means black in ancient Turkic, and in, so also in Turkic. And Kol means the water. So basically, the black waters in old Kyrgyz tradition, an old black stallion is the top of nobility. So anything that's related to black is something very noble. But the town is a frontier town of Karakol, and we got there after 6 hours of driving through the pass that brings you to Issyk-Kul and into the Issyk-Kul Lake, and following the north side of the lake. And we got there, and Karakol is very let down. It's very broken down. It's really like this, gives you this impression of the far west, broken downtown. But it, funnily enough, has its industry on skiing. Some of the higher class of Bishkek sometimes come there to ski. There's a couple of solutions to ski, but the town itself used to be a garrisonal town where the submarine platoon or regiment of the Soviet army used to come to do its testing. So it's got this very like industrial slash old nomadic traditions mixed up there. And we met with an association that helps weavers all around the lake into a syndicate called the OBOP. That is backed by the GICA, that means by the Japanese government, that has been donating money through an association to help the craftspeople understand that if they actually work together, they can be able to, for instance, that OBOP association, very funnily enough, has a contract with the Muji shops that we all know, you know, and they are creating a handmade 100% ecological and traced felt object. So talking felt now, obviously the number one craft that is developed by women crafts, not weavers, but at the end they're craftswomen, they're creating felt, if you understand the creation of the fabric of felt, which has become the center of my installation and my artwork. I've been through these different links with these associations, I was able to go towards the workshop of these craftsmen around the lake and learn how the craft has developed around felt making, the way it is turned into fabric, and the different types of fabric it can be actually produced. And most obviously, interestingly, also the way it's colored and pigmentized. And I went towards those that are the more organic, because obviously you can use a lot of chemicals to create color. Especially when you're not that far from China. So basically, that was my process around the island, around the lake. I took another drive on the south side. And I would advise anybody that goes to Issyk-Kul region to take the south side of the Issyk-Kul Lake. That's just a wonderful experience. I mean, you have this blue lake, these mountainous peaks, and those beautiful villages as you go with yurts, you know, everywhere. You have yaks on the road. It's a wonderful experience. And that's where the village of Kizil 2, K-Y-Z-Y-L, further T-U-U, is based, which is what they call the village of the 100 yurt makers.
I think it's really fascinating. I've never been anywhere like this. So you're painting a wonderful picture. But it is fascinating how maybe we in the Western world have become a little bit more disconnected to what craft making actually means to society and how it shapes cultures and society and empowers women and other people and groups of people to produce things and sell things. You know, we've become a little bit disconnected from that, I think, in our culture. So it's really wonderful, you know, to hear how you're reconnecting with that. So you ended up the journey, you ended up in Istanbul ultimately. What was your route after that?
Well, that was the end part. I was in Istanbul, obviously, to meet with some cultural actors at the end of my trip, very more clearly. Parallel also projects that are going to lead us with our agency. Our agency is called the We Are the Nomads Agency, that also signed the production of the Biennale Pavilion cultural content creation for the Kyrgyz government. But we are also preparing another show with the Istanbul Biennale also for next year. After I went to Kizil 2, where I ordered a cupola of a yurt to be constructed for my installation, we went to another region called the Narin region. That's higher up on the western side of northern Kyrgyzstan. That's another valley. On the western edge, say, of the lake. And there we stayed also in a place called Kushkor, where we sat down with another co-op called Altin Kol, which means literally in English, a golden hands. And that also is a same kind of syndication that unites about 1,000 weavers, craftswomen across the Narin region around a stabilization of prices of wool and such things. And I basically signed an agreement with them to produce about 20, 25 artworks for me. So after that, we had to go back to Bishkek. And we went back to Bishkek, and we're still in Bishkek for weeks because we're just back and forth, if you mind, between the Narin and the Issyk-Kul. I would have to go once and so often back into the mountains to discuss this and that. And so the trip ended more around being in the mountains and in the capital, doing actually a lot of politics, because in the midst, you wouldn't believe it, Lisa, in the midst of my travail, suddenly the government changed. And Mr. Japarov, the president, the acting president, decided to change his cabinet. So the Minister of Culture I was discussing previously had been replaced by a new one. So I had to sit with all of the new administration and walk them through my work for at least 10 days inside the city before I went to Istanbul.
This podcast is very much about life stories through travel. And I think you have an incredible life story, not just the contemporary stuff we're talking about right now, but actually your childhood. So you were born in Tehran in 1973. And of course, not long after that was the Islamic Revolution. So what was your life like growing up, and what did that mean to you?
Well, you have to picture that we had to leave a family home in a beautiful area of Tehran called Fereshte, in the heights of Tehran, to never be back. We were just sent out on a holiday to Rome, and that holiday never ended. So that's the way I remember. I have the collections leaving. I was 4 years old, so I always say that there's a Fellinian part to it, a reconstructive memorial process, where I don't know if some of my memories are actually pictures I've seen or what I really seen. But I still remember saying goodbye to my nanny on the tarmac and going up into this Pan Am flight for Rome. And that was one of the last flights out the city before it was taken by the Ayatollah. So that was like something that's been like emotionally very present in my life, that displacement. But after that, we landed in Paris, where I grew up, where my parents divorced in the middle of this horrendous, what I personally like to call the post-revolution angry seas, that brought us to different shores. I mean, I got separated by my parents and put in boarding school in the North of France, Catholic boarding school, tutored by my grandparents until I was 18, 19 after that. But I grew up with also having the chance to have my father living in Marrakesh, and my father being a very big traveler. He's taught me everything about traveling since childhood. My father used to be a hunter when he was a kid, when he was still, how to say, moral to do it, as he puts it. Then he gave up hunting and went into trekking. So very fast, when I was 16, 17, he acquired a houseboat in Srinagar in Kashmir, and we would go trekking the Himalayas and stay on his houseboat there. So I grew up, with that sense of trekking. And my father would trek basically the way you would trek 2,000 years ago. We wouldn't have anything else than mules, and we would eat with our hands and travel with the nomadic old sense of the idea. So I even have this anecdote where I remember being so hungry that I got some money out of my own pocket and went towards Nomad with one of our guys and bought a mutton for myself, a live one. And we had to execute it at night and feast on it like what we would do thousands of years ago. So it's something that my father always taught me. You were talking about reconnection. I think traveling is like it's got a lot to do with the idea of connection. And I think that a lot of my work also got to do with the sense of displacement and reconnection through traveling. And I was saying I did Catholic boarding school, North France. That was much illuminated, I would say, by the trip of my father. That then moved to Morocco, and we continued doing these treks into the Sahara, where we even got lost one time. We actually really thought we would die. Our guide lost us in the middle of the dunes and got to sleep in the middle of the dunes for a whole night without knowing where our camp was. That was one of the stories also of the travels. And my father basically read the stars and brought us home. So
how on earth had he been taught to that? Was that something handed down through the generations?
Well, yes, as I wanted to also underline, obviously the project, Gates of Turan project, is linked to also our tribe, which is called the Qajar tribe. It's an old tribe that has Turkic descent, and that goes back right up to the 1400s when Tamerlan and the second wave of the Mongol invasions happened, where you had a part of the hordes that went down into Turkey, the other into Persia. And we are not part of the hordes. We were actually like escaping the hordes. We're a sub-tribe that entered Persia in the 1400s and rapidly went into the grades of the army and to the throne, actually, in a family in the 1700s. And so we have old nomadic. And I always say, well, my tribe has always been on the move, has always been, when the people say, oh, which part of Persia, for instance, are you? Well, obviously, we're mostly from the north. We say Tabriz. But we never can pinpoint where our homeland is because we've been on the move continuously. So traveling is in the DNA of my tribe, of my family. And my father, of those, was more of the radical sides, where he always was also a bit of a mystic, a bit of a Sufi, somehow a hippie in the 60s. And he had this approach that was very radical to traveling, where he thought that you had to go back to the essentials. And I learned a lot from my father's teachings, I must admit.
It sounds like a very much a life of contrasts. On the one hand, you've escaped from the after the Islamic Revolution.
you're sent to what must be quite a well-to-do boarding school in France. Your father has managed to travel and live in different places, but also, so that sounds like quite a life of privilege in many ways, but also there you are trekking and slaughtering mutton and deliberately putting yourself out there in these vulnerable and interesting situations.
Well, yes, the contrast has been always stupendous in my life, and I actually got to love it. I think that there's a radical sense of creation to make people react from their everyday lives that needs some type of radicality. So I think that irony, paradoxality into art and even into lifestyle creates richness. And breadth of vision. And I think that breadth of vision, I'm very much close to the teachings of the Tao, says that it's nobility, and nobility is something divine. And that's what the Tao says. I'm just citing Lao Tzu. But I believe that. I believe that it is important that the world in these times of post-pandemic, I don't even want to say post-pandemic. I mean, we're just right now in Glasgow talking about the COP, the COP. I don't know, it's 26, I think. Yeah, and obviously, I say, well, it is good to reconnect, but you got to reconnect in a soulful way too. I call it ecology of soul. You got to, yeah, this has to be a planetary ecology, but you also have to go through something where you reconnect on the inside. And I think that some, as I said earlier, messages coming from archaic tribes or books like the Tao are very interesting because they help you understanding that there must be a concentration on a process of reconnection that has to come from a personal standpoint, not only on a financial, economical, or a political one. So that's my position as an artist too, and it actually is a result of a life of hard contrasts. I mean, I studied architecture. My grandfather was a grand architect. He was a Shah's architect in Iran. That made us for a truthful escape because he would have been executed if we stayed 10 days more. And so I studied architecture, but quit. I then diverted into art school, and from art school I dropped into an indie rock band. 8 or 9 years, I was into the alternative rock scene in France.
Tell me a little bit about that. That sounds interesting.
Well, we toured a lot. Nationally, we signed. I was studying. Art in a graphic way, and a lot of people in there were into film. So I started shooting 8mm avant-garde films, black and white, that were very experimental. And we would basically, most of these people were musicians, and I've always played guitar. My mother got me my first Spanish guitar when I was 14 in south of Spain, and I've always I was into Dylan and into Leonard Cohen and Donovan and all the folkies. And and basically I had written a lot of poems along the way to that stash. So all this just came out the same moment when I met these guys and we started jamming. And before we knew, we were signing on very, very, very cool indie record label that brought us to London. And one of my finest memories is opening for a band called Interpol from New York, which was one of the good bands in New York on the rock revival in the 2003, 4, 5s. Opening for them at the Notting Hill Arts Club. And the Depeche Mode's producer, a guy called Dimitri Tikhova, just approached us after the gig and said, "Hey guys, I want to produce the album." And we did it at his London studio in Notting Hill, called Bedroom Studios. And so great, great trips also linked to travel and touring and experiences on the alternative rock scene made me also stronger on the breadth of you know, there's something that I must obviously say to anybody that wants to get into the artistic career. Obviously, it's a lifetime thing, and it's also a conversation to have yourself that can go from one type of expression to the other. But obviously, I believe that the strongest point that is there is to travel on a long-term basis. It's a very long-term decision. The process of maturation through the years and different expressions brings you to always better yourself. So this is something that I believe very deeply. After that, I mean, that adventure into indie rock didn't last at the time it lasted, and my art took over quite rapidly. As because of crisis also. I don't know if you followed, but I guess everybody did, that the music industry really had a lot of trouble, sustaining its Indiaks. And so in 2008, 2009, most of the record labels went down. And we had a couple of sponsors, but very fast, all my life, my art was always something that that resurfaced whenever I was in need of it. And that's where contemporary art, through the form of also getting married with Camilla, that was working for Nicolas Ghesquiere at Balenciaga, that has a very forward contemporary vision of fashion. Meeting her and getting married and moving south of Spain, and in the south of Spain, just across from Africa, in Tarifa, that's a little village that is a UNESCO protected site, which kept it completely untouched by modernization. Just is situated in a physical way, Lisa, 14 kilometers off the shores of Africa and Tangier. So you wake up in the morning and see Africa there. And I was super, super happy to go and live there. So we moved there in 2012, and I opened a warehouse atelier workshop there that really put me seriously to work on a multidisciplinary approach of contemporary art. Because today, my exhibitions, as hopefully you'll see, mix physical immaterial such as music and video art as much as I think one serves the other.
So many artists and musicians and creative people work tirelessly in their fields, and they still don't have, you know, as much success as you had, and you've just done incredibly well. You've exhibited all over the world. I'm just reading a little bit now: Paris, Hamburg, New York, Dubai, Monte Carlo, Los Angeles, Marrakesh, Tehran, all over, and including the south of Spain, which is where my connection comes with you, actually, because all my childhood holidays were in Tarifa, and I grew up on the Costa del Sol in Malaga. And it smacks of a lot of bravery as well, to go and set up in these places. You know, is what scares you? Is there anything that scares you?
I guess since I took on meditation only a year ago, I tend to understand that maybe I was scared of being, for a long time, I was scared of solitude. And also in the sense of non-activity, in the sense of maybe having to deal with the idea of loss, that's a common vortex in my family. We're all like this. We're very hyperactive. Obviously, it's got to do with the fact that, you know, our family is a very well established family from Iran, and that country has been, I don't know, interweaved into the identity of our beings. And that being taken away from us maybe has created something that we don't want to maybe look at, you know, face value in the mirror. So obviously, that's maybe what scared me the most. But I think, and maybe it explains also this never-ending forward-going dynamic, right? I believe that time and with self-management, you know, you get to know yourself better and manage better your energy. So, yeah, that would be maybe what would maybe scare me maybe the most would be maybe the loss of conversation with myself. And that's something I'm nurturing all the time. I'm trying to keep the curiosity at a high level, open. I try to be open to other cultures, literature, keeping an ear to the ground on different artistic movement. And that has led me, and that's something that's also going to very well link to what I'm doing right now in Room 304 in the Athens Palace Athena in Athens. That's one of the big lessons that we taught ourselves from the pandemic. We could completely decentralize our rapport to the art world. And we created, obviously, a very positive and constructive website and starting developing more online sales. So we started traveling in the sense of the online. And I got myself the Oculus Quest, a headset from Facebook, started working in the metaverse with shows in the metaverse and having clients traveling from anywhere in the world to see my shows in a decentralized way. So we realized, hey, we could actually think about, you know, keeping the gallery in Spain, but, you know, moving to somewhere else. And in our trips, actually, in the last year, since things have eased down a bit, we came across Athens. And And it's incredible to spot the potential here. State of the city resembles something like Berlin after the fall of the wall or something. You know, there is an incredible array of real estate here that could be transformed into beautiful ideas. And I have a lot of people coming from the US, coming from France, coming from everywhere that are streaming into Athens and with incredible ideas. You have art shows every night. You have all of the streets are covered with street art. You don't have a wall or one building that's not covered by this post-anarchist rebellion that happened a couple of years ago. And it's very impressive. And Camilla decided, I fell in love. And we decided to, as the Venice Biennale is going to open next year, to open the Nouvelle Vague Art Spaces Gallery that we have in Marbella, but in Athens. So this is going to be our next big traveling / professional project.
Well, I look forward very much to seeing more of your work. Where can we find you?
You can find me, obviously, in a stable way in the south of Spain, because we're based still. So we're in Soto Grande, where we have our gallery. The We Are the Nomads agency and foundation is based in south of Spain also. So you can find me there. Obviously, on our website on nouvellevaguartspaces.com, where you have my wife's curatorial developments. And if you want to follow the trip that I just outlined into Kyrgyzstan and towards my presentation at the Venice Biennale at the Kyrgyz Pavilion, I have a dedicated website to that project called Gates of Turan. With a U.
Amazing. I'm going to ask you my last question now. My last question is always about music. And if I had to ask you to choose one song that reminds you of a memorable time and place of travel, what is that song and what is the memory?
Wow. I will definitely choose A Sunset on Dal Lake in Srinagar, Kashmir, when I'm 18, 19. On the rooftop of my father's houseboat, with the sunset coming behind the Mongol room, as you mind. And you have to know that Dal Lake is made of lilies. So you have all these lilies and you don't have electric boats. So you have shikaras that are rolling slowly past like that. And my father had a beautiful version of Joan Baez covering Sad Eyed Lady from the Lowlands. That's I think one of the best Bob Dylan songs ever written. And I would it's an 8-minute piece. And I would advise anybody that's traveling in a beautiful part of the world to put that on sunset and to lay back.
That's wonderful. Great juxtaposition: Kashmir, lake, and Bob Dylan. I absolutely like that juxtaposition. Yes, but yet, as you said, would go together very nicely. Thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast.
Well, thank you everyone for this time. I hope that it has made you trip.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for listening to the Big Travel Podcast. I really appreciate every single one of you. We'll be back very soon with more wonderful guests for you.